Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Succession, your weekly podcast where we recap what's just happened on, I guess, everyone's favorite show at this point. Not everyone, but a lot of people. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Sonia Soraya.
So we're here today to talk about episode 5 of season 3, which is kind of confusingly titled Retired Janitors of Idaho. But before we get into the meat of the episode, we, as always, want to turn to our virtual mailbag. That's stuff coming into us from stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Please send us any questions, theories, anything like that. And our subtext, which is a text service you can use if you go to... And on our subtext, which is a messaging service that we use, you can go to joinsubtext.com/stillwatching to sign up, or you can text 213-652-6717. Sonia, I believe we have a text that you wanted to respond to today.
We do. We have we got a couple of texts. It was so thrilling to not be met with several dozen messages telling us we missed something. So thank you for that, guys. One of our listeners, Malcolm, wanted to ask what our schedule is for the podcast, like how far in advance we record. It was a little tricky before the show started airing. We kind of did a couple in a row just to try to get some episodes banked and stuff. Right now, what we're doing is recording midweek. So today is Wednesday for us. So we're in between the last episode and the upcoming episode. The interviews are like all over the place because we're very dependent on talent. And then because we have the holidays coming up, we're, you know, going to be moving stuff around a little too. So please accept our illusion of temporality, but things are always a little haywire behind the scenes.
We're trying to keep as like up to date with like emails and texts and all that as we can, you know, as it pertains to like last week's episode. But sometimes there might be a little bit of delay because, it's a very busy time of year for everyone, including us.
And then we have one more message about last week's episode with our whole digression about classicism and Succession with Sporus and Nero. Listener John said that he thinks that Tom's telling Greg that story because he can't say he would kick Shiv down the stairs and replace her in some way, but he is feeling, I think, a desire, maybe one he can't articulate, to betray Shiv and maybe jump ship or make off for himself in the way that Greg has, at least it looked like Greg has last season, which I think is an interesting note because I've heard a lot of people speculate about Tom and whether or not Tom is going to flip on the Roys. And I guess this episode doesn't really give us a lot of meat in that direction. But he is a big liability for them and he is cracking. So that is definitely something to keep an eye out on.
That's funny because through our email, a listener named Osnat wrote something similar. He said, You guys totally missed a big point. For Tom, Greg is someone he can say and do things he wouldn't dare display in front of the other characters. And what he basically tried to say is at that moment, he is fantasizing about killing his wife, Shiv. I guess, that's a dark read of it. But he's also fantasizing about impregnating her in this episode. But I think, as you mentioned from your research, Sonia, that when Nero did kill his wife, she was pregnant. Isn't that right?
Yes. Yep. Kicked her to death while pregnant. No NBD.
So dark.
Very dark.
Dark stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I think we are seeing certainly in this episode a big, I don't know if it's an advancement, a lateral move or a shift in the Tom and Shiv relationship. A sweet moment immediately spoiled by Shiv's kind of overall distaste for her husband. So we also had an email about another character who is only mentioned in this episode, but that's Marcia, which I think is kind of always a good character to keep in mind.
Yeah, of course. You have to keep, you always have to keep your eye out on Marcia. He, I'm a boss. She could get up to anything. I think we had a few weeks ago, someone pointed out that all of the negotiations that she was initiating in order to like get back with Logan were all references to stuff that had happened in the first season. A lot of financial details that definitely had gone over my head. So what did our listeners say to us?
So Louisa wrote, that she has a theory that Marcia is who takes it all in the end. She has a seat on the board. The pilot is Logan trying to guarantee her too when he dies. She's always inserting herself in important conversation, and she has this kind of quid pro quo loyalty that I see Logan admiring. And I think, you know, it is telling that in this episode, when Logan is in his unmedicated fugue state, whatever you want to call it, he calls out for her. He calls Shiv Marcia, you know, and so she is still in his mind, even if we've kind of only barely seen her this season.
Yeah, looking forward to more on that front. But just because of what we've seen of Marcia, I believe that she could come away on top, and I kind of would root for her, honestly. So this episode, I can't really make heads or tails of retired janitors of Idaho. It must be mentioned in the episode somewhere, or is like another conference that is happening somewhere. I don't know. Maybe somebody's retirement pension. But this episode is all the Waystar Royco shareholders meeting. It feels a lot like the third episode where there's just this big moment, you know, the town hall meeting in that one, and this one's this big moment with the shareholders, and kind of everything falling to bits around the Roy family needing to maintain some sort of being a sort of functional corporate entity and sort of largely failing. So, you know, at the very end of last week's episode, we had Logan in the midst of like a real health, if not exactly a health scare, certainly an indication of how frail his health is. And because that episode was set like out by the ocean in the meadow, you did get this sense of sort of like nature kind of encroaching on, as it inevitably does, on the sort of foibles and frailties of the humans at play. This episode has so much of that same thematic resonance, but is not outside. It's inside this big corporate, you know, the big corporate center. But it's still, death is still lurking around the corner here. So what we find out fairly early on in the episode, and I just think we should start with Logan because his plot is kind of the catalyst for everything else. Turns out that he's on antibiotics, didn't want anyone to know about his antibiotics because he's afraid of people seeing him weak. And so ends up getting very confused, starts maybe delusional, maybe he's hallucinating, or maybe he's just kind of, you know, sort of like a dementia thing where his wires just seem sort of crossed, and he's like, he's trying to talk to Shiv and he says Marcia's name instead. And it's in the midst of this very crucial deal that Waystar Royco is trying to make with Bainsbury Capital, which is the two Sandys, daughter Sandy and dad Sandy, and Stewie, who we know, you know, as, and Josh Aronson too, I assume, who we know as these like big financial players, that if they took over, they would prevent the Roy family from having family control over Waystar Royco. And so, yeah, Logan is supposed to be making all of these decisions, and partway through, but maybe not soon enough, they begin to realize he's not in his right mind, can't take care of himself, needs to pee all of the time. And yeah, and then everyone has to scramble.
Yeah, they scramble in such a way that even though the series opens with, you know, the first season with Logan having the stroke and being incapacitated and everyone's wondering, okay, who succeeds him, hence the title of the show. They really don't seem prepared for this inevitability.
No.
You know, no. In this episode, watching them realize that, like, oh, dad is not himself, he's AWOL, they clearly don't have a plan because they've been so busy trying to, in their mind, save the company that they haven't really allowed themselves to consider the fact that Logan is older and it will someday be gone and his health might be compromised, not just because of this incident. He had a stroke, you know, not too long ago in the show's timeline. You know, this made me think, I was lucky enough last week to go see on Broadway this play, The Lehman Trilogy, which is from an Italian playwright, but has been adapted very beautifully into English. And the production is directed by Sam Mendes, and it follows three actors on stage the whole time for 3.5 hours, playing many, many characters, but at core, really narrating the story of these three brothers from Germany who moved to Alabama in the 1840s and started a cotton business, basically. And then that went on to become the Lehman Brothers Bank, which obviously was one of the big ones to fail in the 2008 financial crisis. And what is so interesting is that you get into the early part of the 20th century, and that's when the family, well, kind of mid-century, actually, when the family loses their position in the company. There's no longer a Lehman in the sort of main office after a certain point. And Lehman did survive for another roughly 40-something years, the name it bore was only kind of symbolic. There wasn't actually a Lehman in there. So it's just interesting to think about that play, which people should see if they're in New York and have the time, about family companies and about what it means for the family to either just kind of fade away or be pushed out. And clearly, the Roy family in this episode, in the form of Logan's mortality, is realizing their own more metaphorical mortality in terms of this company may forever bear their name in Royco, but they are not guaranteed to be involved.
Yeah, I really liked that this episode had the parallel of Big Sandy. No one in the episode uses these terms, but I don't know how else to distinguish between two, a father and son, both named Sandy. Big Sandy, Dad Sandy, is also, you know, disabled, but more outwardly, very obviously impaired. And so everything you hear from him throughout all of these tense negotiations is just him sort of whispering or kind of like groaning into his daughter's ear, little Sandy, which is Hope Davis. And it's so weird. Like at some point, you know, Roman says, and he's being very clever and proud of himself, he's like, oh, it's just like a meat puppet. You just have a meat puppet who is your kind of like the fully articulated front of the money. It's just you have an embodiment of the money and you have to keep him alive and ask him how to do things because that's how it has worked for so long. But both of these people are falling apart because that's what happens to human beings. Eventually you will die, but no one is even able to confront that. I was especially interested in it's such a devastating, aside from how funny it is, because it is funny, it is just everyone is losing. Logan loses in this situation, the kids lose in this situation, the company loses in this situation. Assuming that you think that the Roy family should be in charge of Waystar Royco, but it just sort of feels like all of these, it really feels like the illustration of the gerontocracy, you know, where there's like a massive amount of power and wealth concentrated to the very oldest people in this entire meeting. And I think that you know, to move on to some of the other characters here. So, like, both Roman and Jerry have, like, a lot of stuff happening in this episode. One thing that really struck me is how the illusion of Logan's control and Logan's, like, say-so, his kind of, like, his sort of overseeing on high and making sure that everything is okay, is a real security blanket for both of these characters in particular. Roman seems to really fall apart when he realizes that Dad is no longer, like, doing the sort of, like, big power moves and, like, muscling his way into things and saying to, like, go fuck them all and stuff. And he's actively, like, on the side. Roman's like, yeah, Dad, say to just fuck them all. That's, like, what you do. And you know what you're doing and you're always gonna win. It's like, Roman, calm down. This guy is, like, on the threshold of death.
Yeah, yeah. Roman has always sort of pathetically, sadly, clinged to this notion of his father as this towering, all, you know, omnipotent, omniscient figure. And Logan does function as that at times, but clearly when faced with his frailty and his humanity, Roman freaks out. He keeps insisting, you know, he's got a plan. He's working. He knows something we don't. He's always six steps ahead, which I have to imagine in the writer's room for this episode, there had to have been some conversation about the way Trump was spoken about, Oh, no, this is all strategy. He's playing 3D chess. That man was not playing any chess. He wasn't even playing checkers, you know, but you can build up this mythos. In Logan's case, it's earned to some extent. He's been a very shrewd and ruthless and obviously successful businessman. But this kind of supernatural thing that Roman especially is imbuing into him in this episode is real desperation, in the same way that we, you know, in a lot of culture, we sort of put perhaps an undue mythical kind of force into older people. You know, they're all seeing, all knowing, wise, sort of connected to some other realm. And I don't know, maybe that is true for some people, but, like, I think it's a lot of that is just protection against what is so scary about people at that age.
Right, about being and about having to, I think, like, with all of the kids, you see this in different ways, but about, like, having to step up to the occasion. That's, like, so much of what this whole episode is, like, what if your security blanket is gone, or what if the person who is in charge is gone and you are now the person in charge? I think it's, like, generationally, this is something that I've thought a lot about, because I think, like, demographically, if you look at just, like, who has a concentration of wealth and power and, like, management positions, or even if you look at the breakdown of, like, the age of people who are holding public office, who are in the Senate, out the millennial generation and certainly the Gen Z generation is, like, disproportionately underrepresented, even though we're adults. We could be senators, we could be heading companies, but it's full. All of those spots are full by other people. And I think there's sort of an interesting tension there of being, on one hand, like, oh, well, at least someone else is in charge, so I don't have to be in charge. And there's, like, frustration there, but a little bit of, like, oh, thank God it's not me, that's sort of yanked away in this episode. So I was very keyed into, obviously, all of the Roman and Jerry stuff that's happening in this throughout this episode. I have to say, they really also, this episode is also very much playing up the romantic quality of it, just even in the way it's, like, filmed and directed between these two. They are having a whole plot line that nobody else, like, they're talking to each other and nobody else is even acknowledging it. It's like it's the stuff of fan fiction dream. I am telling you, the fans must be losing it over this episode. But I really liked it. At the same time, to me, it felt very revealing for both Jerry and Joy Roman to be finding the solace in each other in this moment of crisis, but then also at the same time admitting that they both really need Logan. They both really like it when Logan is in charge, and in a way they have all of this, like, they have all of this ability to communicate, but it's because they're both so fully complicit in, you know, the Logan and Roy project.
Yeah, I mean, I've always sort of wondered why anyone on this show wants to be CEO of this company, you know, because it seems like a really scary, not thankless, I mean, it's thanked in terms of salary and power and all that, but, you know, it doesn't seem like a fun job. And I think that it's interesting to look at, you know, it's mostly played as a joke when you have, you know, Frank and Jerry kind of vamping on stage, just trying to, you know, fill time and talk about the company to all these shareholders who could be retired janitors from Idaho. And it's like, I kind of think about like, oh, you know, they do actually have jobs. Like they do know what the business is. They can talk about it. So there is some vague sense of competency, even though this episode is such a noises off kind of doors flying open and characters entering and exiting kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There is at least some business there. And what I think as it pertains to Roman and Jerry was interesting on that front. So Jerry goes out, Frank kind of throws her under the bus and is like, okay, now please welcome interim CEO Jerry. And she is talking about the future of the company and her past with the company. And she calls Roman a visionary.
Yes.
And he perks up at that in this kind of affectionate, appreciative way, very subtly. So no one really takes notice of it. And I think that, you know, you're talking about like the gerontocracy and, you know, the one business or major industry, let's say, that I think in this country seems to be a little bit skewing younger is tech, right? And you there's all talk about visionaries like Zuckerberg and, oh God, who made Twitter? What's his name?
Jack Dorsey.
Jack Dorsey, thank you.
Yep,
who
no
made
problem.
Twitter? And yes, those people are young, and you could call them visionaries for good and bad, I suppose. And I just think there's a funny, again, pathetic sort of irony or quality to the fact that, like, oh, gee, what a happy coincidence that this young, you know, upstart visionary also happens to be the boss's son. You know,
right?
I don't know if that's actually true in terms of Roman's business prowess. We've seen him make major mistakes and have some successes. But so they're conscious of the language of evolution, of change, of maybe trying to bring a younger voice in, but it still is stuck in this antiquated ecosystem. You know, they can't ever really think about, you know, finding someone from without to shake things up.
Right. Well, of course, Jerry is just as invested in the nepotism of it as anyone else, even though she's not a member of the family. And it's interesting to me because that that speech that she gives, there's a couple of moments, I think it's with Frank too, where you see they're very deliberately showing you, you know, the episode is putting kind of a button on it. They're going off script. Like, you see the teleprompter and you see what it says, and then they're not saying what that on stage, like, which I think is sort of to feed like the kind of the chaos of this episode. But it's specifically with Jerry mentioning Roman. Earlier, when Jerry and Roman and Shiv, I think one other person, were in a meeting, well, Frank probably, were in a meeting with the Sandys. And I think something happens, Jerry said, like, kind of overrides something Roman says and is like, we have to check with your dad about this. And Roman gets upset. He says, you have to pick your prince, which is a really interesting way of framing it. Like, but then she does. I think that's another interesting decision. And I don't know if that's Jerry's own sense of survival, but throughout the episode, she seems to really see something in Roman. And this episode, Roman goes from someone who says, can you please call me when it's less scary, when he's looking at the TV, to literally fielding a phone call from a very angry president of the United States. I have to say, that scene with the phone call is just fantastic. Just the energy is so fantastic. Everyone is like firing on all cylinders. Everyone's like sweating. Like, I just feel like everyone's freaking out. And then Connor's in the middle, like, oh, I want to talk to the president. And this group of people has to come up with some way of making it, of not directly telling Connor that he can't talk to the president, but getting someone else, anyone but Connor, to talk to the president at the same time. And Jerry puts Roman up, you know, brings him up to the plate. He's like, she's like, it's your time, and makes a case to everyone else, says that he's the he's bootleg Logan, if anyone is. And it kind of works out nicely because in that moment, Shiv has gone off to do her own conniving. So it's not like it's Roman v. Shiv here. It's just, can Roman step up to his own potential, which is like, it's such a like, it's like a very like patronizing way of seeing him as like a child who like needs to grow up. But at the same time, he is someone who's struggling to like be an adult version of himself. And so there's something, you know, even though I presumably loathe the president and loathe whatever Roman is trying to accomplish in talking to the president. I was so proud of Roman for making that whole conversation work.
Yeah, I mean, although I will say that it turned out that it wasn't something that needed to be negotiated. It was just the president being like, I'm not running for a second term, you know,
right.
because of this thing that they helped perpetuate about his cognitive health. And so, you know, there you have a third leg in this, a third piece of this triptych of failing old men. Where all these people are scrambling for their seats. Mm. Roman didn't royally screw it up, but there wasn't really much for him to do on that, on his side of the phone call. He could just had to listen to this angry guy be like, I've had enough. I'm done. And so then that does potentially, there's been a lot of talk of the administration in this season, more so than there has been in past seasons. So you wonder if that does leave room for a new political figure to enter the picture.
Right. And of course, Ken Connor standing there like, let it be me.
right. Yeah.
That is interesting. And yeah, we might as well move on and start talking about Connor too, because, the politics in this show, we had talked a few weeks ago about how, you know, the fat Michelle Ann seems to be working for a very Trumpian guy. But my husband mentioned when we were watching this episode that the neurological capabilities thing, and even a president who would leave office for his wife and child, sounds a lot more like Biden, actually. And that maybe, you know, this portrait of this fictional president is sort of maybe a hybrid of the two, and maybe giving the show some space to respond with their own political force. Now, of course, Connor in this episode, even though he's so eager to talk to the president, has also sort of finagled his way into Europe, which is not America.
Right. He's invaded Europe.
So the story there is that he's trying to get Logan to agree to letting him take over a European cable. Logan's lucid and is like, yeah, I don't know about this. And then about 10 minutes later, Logan's not lucid anymore. And Connor's like, oh, yeah, Dad totally agreed to let me have European cable. Nobody thinks that Logan really signed off on it, everyone seems to be okay with letting Connor have this.
Yeah, I mean, I think back to the premiere episode of this season when Connor is tasked with holding down the Balkans or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's gone from the Balkans to the rest of Europe, I suppose. Even though his siblings are like, no, Dad was definitely not in like good health when he said that. I know that for sure. I don't know when he started this whole decline thing, but I know that the European cable thing was part of that. You also wonder, like, is it good populist presidential strategy for Connor if that's what he wants to do, you know, for the next election, to go run European cable? Doesn't that sound awfully sort of fancy and foreign for someone who's running on a populist ticket? I don't know.
Yeah, but they even have like red meat and American flags out there? I don't think so.
I mean, maybe in France. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to, I mean, clearly Connor doesn't know what he's doing either. I guess like the one thing that I found myself wondering about, and maybe we'll pick up on this, is, you know, in that scene with the phone call from the president, Connor keeps trying to get the phone and no one will give him the phone. And I know that he knows, he seems to have a fairly clear picture of where he stands at the company, but he must have some feeling about it. He must have some sense of resentment or humiliation or whatever, and I'm curious to see when that emerges.
Well, I think that some facet of that is revealed in the fact that he is willing to like at least make the threat that he's going to expose. He's going to open the closet and there all the skeletons are, you know.
Right.
And
right.
I think because he realizes that might be one of his last remaining chips, his last bit of leverage. So in some senses, I feel he has accepted the fact that he is, well, he's turned his doltish black sheep identity into a badge of honor, you know, well, I'm the one who gets it. I'm a man of the people, all that sort of political ambition. Then again, you have him showing up to the room where everyone's waiting to, you know, see what happens with the vote. And Roman says like, oh, good, you're a vital part of this, like, very sarcastically. Connor says, thanks. And he doesn't say thanks all that sarcastically.
Right. He's willing to accept the illusion. Yeah. Yeah. Well, while we're talking about people who are kind of off and doing their own things, let's talk about Greg for a little bit. Because Greg is there the whole time in this episode, but his personal situation is really going through some changes. And kind of like Connor, he's sort of trying to make all of this tumult work for him. But what he discovers at the beginning of this episode is that Kendall's thinking about burning him, which means turning him over to the DOJ because Greg's left Kendall's camp, is no longer cooperating with the government, is now back at Waystar Royko with like some sort of package. And then when Greg gets worried about that and tries to contact his lawyer, Peter Reigert, we discover that he actually fired that lawyer, and now Peter Reigert and his grandfather, played by James Cromwell, like have no faith in him, see him as, you know, nothing but a terrible capitalist, and are giving his inheritance to Greenpeace.
Yeah. Yeah. And Greg is so thrown for a loop, like again, in terms of considering possibility and or inevitability and mortality and all that, it doesn't seem to have, even though there was talk of this in earlier season, like it doesn't seem to have factored into Greg's thinking that he could be out of the will, you know, right. and his grandfather says, I'm going to give away your part first.
Right.
And Greg is like, how could you even calculate that? You know, it's, you know, so now that really puts him further up against a wall. He has, in his grandfather's eyes, at least made his choice once and for all.
Yeah.
And he has in so doing offended the dear friend of his grandfather, apparently. And by the way, speaking of Peter Reigert, I recently watched for the first time the movie Crossing Delancey. I don't know if you've ever seen that, with Amy Irving, and Peter Reigert is like the love interest, the sexy pickle merchant in the Lower East Side in the 80s.
Okay, amazing.
Very good. If you want to see him playing younger and you know, handsome and swoony. So anyway.
Well, and it's funny because I really hope we get more from him and more from Cromwell. I'm kind of assuming we do, just because it would be so, like, I want to see more about, like, how they're going to either punish Greg or at least see through the end of whatever Greg's plot line is going to be for this season. And at the same time, it's just, you know, Greg's, like, whole mode is hesitation in this, especially over the last few episodes, where he's sort of trying to get, like, sort of trying to work things to his advantage, but then sort of can't bring himself to really use people in the way that he knows he's, like, kind of supposed to. So instead, he sort of shows up and asks a lot of, like, stammering questions, and he's like, well, wait, why isn't this working out for me? I don't understand why it's not working out for me. I also, you know, I recently was watching Seinfeld, and the Greenpeace thing, where the end of the episode is Greg out here suing Greenpeace. Like, he's like, how can I somehow sue this charitable organization to get my money back? I just think Greenpeace is, to me, such kind of like a throwback to a specific moment in time. And I think maybe that's what the I'm sure that they still exist. But there's something about, you know, James Cromwell's character, Greg's grandfather, and Logan's brother being like, I'm divesting from this world of banks, and I'm instead going to like harass ships now out in the ocean.
Right.
That is so funny and seems kind of quaint. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and he's thinking about, like, he's calling to see if he can sue his grandfather. And he's like, is there a way to do that affectionately?
Yes.
Which is a great Greg line. I believe also, James Cromwell says something like crapulence or something, or crapulent about the family. He just uses these great antiquated words. And yeah, Greenpeace, I'm sure they're still, you know, out there doing good work. But yeah, that was a big, you know, hot button news thing in the 70s and the 80s, you know, with these images of these boats chasing down whaling ships or whatever else. But you know, for this family and everything they value, which Greg is included, that would be the ultimate violation. This whole amassed fortune squandered by, you know, wasted by trying to save whales or whatever.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Okay, let's talk about Kendall now, who is, man. Well, I mean, we got to start with, Kendall starts this episode talking to Stewie, and we get, ta-da, a Vanity Fair cameo moment. Where I guess Kendall's just giving Stewie a little bit of a rundown on like his headspace, and Stewie says, yeah, save that for Vanity Fair, bro. I'm all good.
Yeah, Kendall says, I'm all about change.
Thank you. Yes, I'm all about change. Which is kind of an empty corporate platitude, and one that we absolutely would record in that Vanity Fair, because a billionaire would be saying it, and that would be interesting. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was kind of a funny nod to, I mean, and a funny nod to how, like, important that public image, that sort of, and I feel like the word woke has become so problematic and pejorative in the way that it's used, but I think that the way that Kendall is thinking about it is just as limited and sort of frustrating as that has become, which is just that Kendall wants to be positioned woke in some way, and he's kind of doing everything he can in this episode to sort of to embody that or be that. And I think like the essential takeaway from everyone is they're like, Kendall, we don't care about you. We don't want you here. You don't want to be here. And it's creating a little bit of a crisis for him.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to the line from last week about we don't get embarrassed.
Yeah.
You know, and Logan, or rather, Kendall does get embarrassed. And maybe he doesn't always realize that he's made a fool of himself, but he does care more about the relative smallness of public opinion than do a lot of his family members. And I think that is something, in some ways, a good thing for him, that he is a tiny bit more in tune with discourse that isn't just about board meetings and shareholders and all that, but something a bit bigger and more widespread. But at the same time, he's not as savvy about it as he thinks he is.
No.
And that's where that sort of embarrassment starts to come in. You know, he is definitely debased at the end of this episode by this nasty little trick with him going to this tiny room to wait for his dad, who of course was never going to show up. And you know, so you really, it's hard to really feel tons of empathy for Kendall ever, but in this episode, all of his kind of whiz bang, you know, trying to make a statement by saying the names of the women who were horribly treated by this company, you know, it just routinely fails him. And yet he is so much more keenly aware of how that failure looks to the outside world than anyone else in his family even thinks about, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't care what Twitter is saying about them, but Kendall deeply does.
Kendall deeply does. Yeah. I thought a lot, you know, so his stunt in the show, I think, is just pure. I mean, I found it to be sort of pure comedy. Like it is really, we've talked before about how, you know, the victimized people, the victimized women of Waystar Royco have not really had much of a presence. We know they exist. The family knows they exist, but you know, they're very much out of sight, out of mind. And Kendall goes on stage and interrupts Tom and tries to make this a thing, says all of their names in this sort of like boring sort of intonation. Even here, it strikes so hollow. Like even for us who I think have more investment in like who the victims of Waystar Royco on, even for us, it comes off as empty and sort of pathetic, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. Entirely hollow, opportunist. You know, I don't know if a shareholders meeting is really the best venue for that kind of reflection and acknowledgement. I mean, those shareholders should be piercingly aware of these people and their names and what happened to them. But yeah, he's just, this episode is Kendall, I think, realizing, at least in this round, this battle, that he has lost and that he is quickly losing leverage, as expressed at the end of the episode, because you know, Logan's like, block that phone number. He doesn't need him anymore. They avoided the takeover. What else can Kendall offer at this point? And you know, all Kendall has now is this kind of weird half successful public you know, opinion sort of makeover that he's done for himself.
You know, and the other thing is that Kendall really wants to be in the room. I think like the moments when he comes in and confronts Roman and Shiv are some of, to me, some of the most interesting and kind of fraught, because there's genuinely an actual power vacuum at play. Like, Kendall could step into this power vacuum, but he's positioned himself so poorly and kind of seems he always seems like he's blustering when he's trying to assert himself, that no one is interested or impressed with him. And I think he just really wants to be relevant. Yeah. And just simply cannot be. You know, his expensive PR team headed by Barry Schneider, who's in this episode, are like, do not go, like, they don't want him to go on stage. He keeps saying that he doesn't like being absent, and she says, well, your very absence has a certain power, which is a great sort of PR speak for, like, please shut the fuck up. But, you know, he's like, well, my absence makes me feel like a little bitch. Like, he really can't let go that need. All of the things that Shiv and Roman say to him when he shows up and starts, like, shouting about the fact that clearly Logan is unwell, are, like, really funny and cutting, too. Yeah. Kendall keeps saying, like, you are not welcome. Like, no, I'm sorry, not Kendall. Roman keeps saying, like, thank you for your concern. Like, please, you are not welcome and you have no right to be here. That's an imaginary cat. Now fuck off. Just, like, it's sort of, it's so farcical, but you know, it really means a lot to Kendall. And he's not with his family in this moment. And I think that's part of the loss.
And it really, those bits where, you know, you're not welcome here, all that stuff, that really stuck out to me too, because it felt like the first time we've really seen the siblings be like, we're done with you. Like, right. you don't have any place here. Go away. You've created all these problems. We're not really interested in negotiating. We think we have this sorted out on our own, and therefore we don't need to make nice with you. And as much as Kendall and his siblings are forever at war, going back to, you know, all the way to the beginning of the show, there is still some need, affection, some combination of those things in play, at least for him, that seems to have exhausted in everyone else. And, yeah. You know, he's very much alone in this episode.
But here's the thing. They do have it under control, and we're going to talk about Shiv in a second, but Kendall is still right about their dad. And that's the problem. At the end of the episode, that's the problem. Logan has, I really want to hit this because I think it's important. Logan's issues hurt him. Logan's issues hurt himself the most. And now he's afraid of people seeing him weak. So he's lashing out, and he's lashing out at the people who fixed all of his problems for him. He's lashing out at Kendall for, you know, genuinely just for, like, trying to do the right thing, at least in some capacity. And as much and as everyone around Logan is like, oh, Kendall, you are the bad guy. You shouldn't be here. At the end of the episode, everyone's like, oh, right. Logan's a piece of shit. That is important to hit home.
Yeah. I mean, Shiv, you know, sets up what seems to be a fairly decent deal with little Sandy.
Yeah.
And then is in really embarrassing fashion. I mean, they don't get embarrassed, but other people would find this embarrassing. He just berates her, and she has to laugh and say, it looks like someone's feeling better in this very sad way.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about, and it's very funny to me, because last week we had talked about Shiv wearing pencil skirts, and I'm not going to digress about wardrobe too much, but this week she is wearing a pencil skirt, and I thought it was actually, first I was like, oh man, I've been smacked in the face by my own convictions. But then throughout the episode, I was like, you know, I don't think I'm like inventing this. I think she's uncomfortable in that pencil skirt. I think there's something about her discomfort and also impossible challenges of being the Roy daughter, the only Roy daughter, where she has to take on a role and a way, the way that people see her, that she doesn't want, but she has to do it anyway in order to, like, move forward in some way. I really felt for her in this episode. I mean, Shiv has been purely poisoned by all girl boss energy and, like, everything, like, all of the work that she's doing for her father is, like, in service of a corrupt company that like hurts people. And we know this, but, you know, last week we had talked about how she, like, finally kind of starts cracking skulls and getting things done. And this week, you see Shiv is capable of negotiating. Shiv is capable of doing this sort of back-channel deal of making the phone call and of saying, like, we don't have to tell our dads about this for us to, like, make a deal and move forward, which is exactly the type of behavior that Logan, like, ought to be applauding her for, because that's how, that's what he would have done. Like, that's how he wants her to be, ostensibly. But he can't actually maintain a threat to his power for this long. And the fact that she's a girl, I think, really does bear on this. Like, she doesn't have a board seat, but I believe Roman and Kendall both have board seats, right? And when, at the end of the episode, when she starts trying to get a little bit more recognition from her dad, and he yells at her for buzzing in his ear, which to me is like, you're a secretary. You're a secretary and you are like speaking above your station. You need to go back to your typewriter and sit down.
Yeah. And this is, you know, in following the thing last episode where he was like, you know, they're not happy with how, you know, your involvement here. Like, you need to step back or whatever. And
right.
Yeah. And I also think that the Shiv struggling in her position in her father's eyes and the company's eyes is compounded by this bizarre interlude in which Tom, in an effort to congratulate her, but also I think in one swift move, he's trying to repair something that is much more broken than kind of moment of whimsy can fix. He's like, well, talking about getting pregnant. And he's been monitoring her ovulation cycles to some, you know, I don't know how closely, but he's aware of it. And
not creepy at all.
No, it's not creepy. It's nice. You know, and she freaks out about that because it is creepy. To some extent, because this is not a mutual dialogue that they're having about her ovulation, but also because it's like, are you still see me as being put in that box of, you know, getting pregnant and having a kid that waiting for you when you get out of prison, put one in for when you get out, like, you know, she says the term breed, you don't want to breed me, you know,
right.
That is, you know, she could do both. I mean, Jerry has kids, but right. I think she's really chafing against the way that she could very easily, in a very sexist company, in a very sexist world, be sidelined solely for the fact that she's a woman. Nothing else. None of her successes, none of her failures would do her in. It's just something innate about her, which is maybe to some extent what the other children, the other Roy children, are kind of realizing in this episode, minus maybe Roman, who has more deftly played this game than the others.
Right. No, I mean, Roman sees his dad the most clearly in a way too, and then sort of fully accepts him. But I feel like we've seen Shiv really trying to get Logan's approval, right, throughout this whole season, and being kind of blind to his manipulations, sort of convincing herself that she could be the favored child. And I think Logan's toyed with her on it, you know, all of last season with the Pierces. It was this idea, you know, it was like, oh, well, I guess they're into feminism, so let's kind of throw them, you know, this kid, let's see what happens. But, you know, throughout this episode, so much of the Shiv is often in any given scene in this episode, the one that is trying to build consensus, the one that is trying to solicit different opinions and then see, you know, if there's like common ground that can be found. And then she's the one that's like, shouldn't we do this? Doesn't someone have to do something now? Like, don't we need to do something about this deal? She takes over running a whole bunch of things. Administratively, yes, perhaps, but in a way that also is like necessary leadership for what's happening. Maybe it's not exactly, I don't know. Then she gets no credit for it. She gets no credit for it, like no respect for it. I mean, she gets some credit from some of the other people in the company. You know, Frank at the end of the episode, like, makes a point of saying, like, Shiv, I think you really pulled something together here, and that's great. And as soon as this moment's really heartbreaking. As soon as she tries just a little more affection from Logan, just a little bit more recognition from him, he really crushes her. I mean, that is a crushing moment. And she plays it off really well. She's like, haha, I guess he's back on his energy. And then she sort of retreats to Tom, who kind of gives her a hug that she doesn't even want. And then this is such a small moment, but Roman comes up to Logan after and is like, oh, was she being a real bitch? Like, you know, hey, dad, the women suck. And Shiv sees that. And I can see that she's heartbroken by that, too. And she sort of tries to, like, get Roman to look at her and sort of tries to smile at him. And she's sort of trying to say, like, oh, I can do this. I'm like one of you guys. But she's not. They keep telling her she's not. And I feel so frustrated on her behalf, just that, like, there's nothing she can do. This is a very impossible set of circumstances for her to try to succeed. And maybe by the end of this episode, she's seeing it, that she's like, this is never going to work. These people are never going to see me. My dad is never going to see me as someone who can really be the CEO. But I don't know.
Yeah, and especially all the more poignant in its way, because when we first meet Shiv in this show, she's the... not the apostate exactly, but she's doing other things. She's working for more progressive causes or politicians. And she's, you know, she has defined herself by her lack of Roy-ness, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, you know, her journey thus far in the show has been entering the fray, entering the sort of hive mind and the core of this company and her father's tempers and all that. And she's still not getting what she wants, even though she's kind of followed the line as best as she can now. And you know, you also do wonder if her earlier Shiv's sort of I'm not part of this company, I'm different than you guys, if that was itself a ploy to sort of get her father's attention, you know, not to say that she didn't have the values or whatever, but like I think she's kind of shown that she hasn't, but you know, all of these kids are just minus Roman, kind of, but still him. Just so jockeying in their own sad ways to get the clouds to break and the sun to shine on them in the form, yes, of their father in a way that's never going to happen. And I think that is part of the panic about him being dying. Yes, it's about the company. It's about who takes over. But it's also like, I may never get closure on this, ever.
Right, right. Yeah. And it's like, this is our last chance. Yeah, yeah. It's really brutal. We've talked a little bit about the parallels between Jerry and Shiv, and I just wanted to bring up that, so not only is the pencil skirt in play, but also, like, at the very, you know, at the very end when Logan yells at Shiv, he's trying to have a conversation with Jerry, and you get a few cutaways to J. Smith Cameron's face, and I felt like I saw Jerry both being like, I know exactly what Shiv is going through, and I know that what she's doing is about to blow up. Like, she's pushing too hard. This guy can't see her this way. I thought that was kind of interesting too. I don't anticipate like an actual alliance there or something, which is maybe a pity, but I can see I find myself wondering, like, given what we know about women at this company in other arenas, like, what has Jerry been through in order to get to where she is?
And she does, you know, make a point of emphasizing when she stumbles on stage and has to make up remarks that she's been there for 30 years.
Yes.
And I mean, this person has put in the time, and yep, in all of those years, I mean, granted, she doesn't have the sort of filial thing with Logan that obviously his children do, but it, you know, after all of that work that she's put in, all the time she's put in, interim CEO, so you're at the top sort of, but it's a very precarious place, and you see her throughout this episode shirking off certain things that maybe she would otherwise, you know, she would take the president's call, she would go on stage and vamp for as long as she needed to, but not wanting to expose herself, even though she is the most prominent person in the company sort of at this point.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think I think just to, like, the episode kind of put a button on it, because you get a few glimpses of whatever, like, in-house video they made about, like, how much Waystar Royko, like, believes in women. And it's both Jerry and Shiv doing these, like, terrible corporate platitudes, like, to the camera. So really, it's a really interesting observation. And I kind of appreciate that the show is also not trying to say, like, this problem of these entitled women not being recognized at this big billion-dollar company is not, like, the biggest problem in the world. It's not the biggest problem that's happening right now. But it is a problem. It is a problem that's happening, that these people in charge literally don't seem to be able to see women outside of this kind of the female sphere. Which it goes back to the whole pregnancy thing. I mean, I don't know exactly what Tom was thinking. I mean, well, no. I mean, I'm sure we can imagine exactly what Tom was thinking. He's going through a lot. It's very human of him to be like, maybe we could invest a little in the future here. Like, we keep talking about all this money and all of this power. Like, wouldn't it be nice to maybe have more people to share it with, or like something like that? But, you know, family and having a baby, like, for Shiv, like, is not something, it's just not even on her radar. It's like, but that unwanted mantle, you know, of the female sphere, the female responsibilities keep like coming down on her anyway.
Yeah. Poor Shiv. I don't know. Yes, poor Shiv. Poor everyone, I suppose.
Poor everyone. So this week, our colleague Joy Press is talking to Sarah Snook, who plays Shiv, and Matthew McVagin, who plays Tom Wamscans, about this big episode for them and what it means.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
I want to talk to you today about episode 5, which is the big shareholder meeting. So, things that have come before that. So, but I wanted to ask you, Shiv and Tom's relationship seems to be on quicksand in season 3. Can you talk a little bit about where the characters stand, where the relationship stands?
At that point in the series. You mean?
Yeah. I mean, really kind of up to that point in season 3, it seems like they are rather tetchy with each other.
Well, we picked up right after season. I mean, really, it's after that scene on the beach in Croatia, and then we go into panic mode, don't we?
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
The seamless, it just goes straight on. So yeah. We haven't really had time to digest, talk, or deal with it.
And yeah. Really, if you think about it, we've only just gotten married.
Yeah. I'm still reeling from the open marriage thing.
Yeah, it doesn't bode well at this point.
No.
I think quicksand's a good descriptor for sure. It does feel like that in a lot of ways. I think I also realized, you know, in talking about this recently, is that they've previously had a long-term strategy for what their relationship is going to be and what their careers and life and how it's going to look, and they'll get married and Tom will be in ATN and then he will move up somehow and Shiv will be in politics. But then, beginning of season 2, when Shiv's offered the CEO, you know, like that blows it all up. And that now they're having to manage a marriage and a relationship as newly part of the family and also as newly career together, you know, like Shiv was outside before and now Shiv is very much in Tom's space, and it is also Shiv's own, like it's her space originally. So it's in a interesting position for them, I think. And so yeah.
And also there's a sort of awful threat of possible jail time hanging over Tom and them both. And yeah. You know, Tom, you know, they've talked about having a baby maybe and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, all these normal things for families and marriages to have to deal with: jail time and babies.
Yeah.
So I love the detail that he started tracking her periods.
Not creepy.
It is creepy though. It is.
It's supposed to be fun.
How do you not laugh when you're doing that scene? I mean, that scene is just
very hard.
It was difficult. There were plenty of times where we were not able to get through it. And also, I mean, they didn't use them, but like so many like fuck you moments as she's leaving, which I loved, and they were so difficult to get through as well. Yeah,
I'm vibing to your sexy window, I say to you at one point.
Yeah, I loved the like taking your base. What are you trying to take my basal temperature with your dick? Like.
It's amazing. So some of those alt lines didn't make it into the
no
final version. That's a shame. does Shiv have a sense of what she wants other than kind of Logan's affection?
Oh, I think she wants success and stability and she wants to win. I think in terms of. The company, but also in terms of the competition within the family to appear the most normal and stable, I think, and part of that was getting married in the first place. I think the realization is that you're always going to be a Roy, and you're probably never going to be normal and stable, and you're never going to you're never going to win at that. So maybe that's what this season's about for her as well.
And I think Tom is belatedly. Realizing that, isn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Some would say that that Greg is Tom's true romance on the show.
Well, I think Greg's probably it's a complicated relationship, but it's probably a little simpler than his and Shiv's, which makes it really devastating when Tom does try to, when he tried to break up with him in halfway through season two, because it was just a repeat. But I think, yeah, there's a lot in there. They're his two main relationships, I'd say, in the show.
He's quite sweet to Greg at times in this season.
I think he enjoyed being a sort of mentor figure, father figure, even. And then he just can't help himself but kind of kick the cat because he so much. Shit himself, it's really hard not to. And I think that just
it's the bully is often the bullied,
absolutely.
And that's me then bullying Tom, and then I'm being bullied by Dad, and so round and round we go,
right.
Right, it's like dominoes.
Yeah,
totally.
The scenes Matthew, the scenes with you and Nick Braun are so kind of unpredictable and tense sometimes. How much do you prepare for those kinds of scenes?
I learn my lines and I just let them sort of percolate, in the days and weeks before we get to shoot them and use my imagination and also just bounce off Nick, like I bounce off Sarah and bounce off, if you're working with such talented actors, I'm full of anticipation as to what they're going to do in the scene. So, there's not, if I come in with too much preparation or thought, it's not always useful. It's, you can become unstuck a bit because you're not sort of, what's exciting is seeing what they're going to do and how you come up with together, I guess. We've got the gift of these amazing scenes, so you just sort of jump in.
Episode 5 has very high stakes, and in the middle of it all, Logan goes piss mad.
What a great phrase.
The demented piss mad king of England, just exactly. That feels like a kind of perfect phrase. And everyone around him is sort of terrified of saying that the emperor has no clothes. I mean, for Shiv, is that out of kind of worship or fear of kind of crossing Logan?
Well, I mean, she also is the only one at the end who in the end, actually does something about it. So I think there's something about Shiv. There's a little bit Logan in that she can flick the switch and be less empathetic and more practical, pragmatic, business-minded, got to get this thing done, like the person who's dealing with a car crash, who doesn't really conceive of what's going on other than we got to get these things done in this order to save this company, save this life. But I think, you know, it is always a risk going against Logan. It's always a risk crossing. But at the same time, again, Shiv is similar to Logan in that, like, the company is the priority. And also I think she knows long-term she can save the company, then that's always going to win the affection of her dad. Just in the short term, of course, Logan's in a, you know.
In the finale of season two, it seemed like Logan was kind of disappointed because Shiv didn't want to make the hard choice of choosing a fall guy for the company. And yet, as you said, she really kind of comes through in this episode. It's like the two sideline daughters.
Totally. Yeah.
Make a deal.
I mean, yeah, totally. And I think that's probably signifying a little bit of growth, you know, as well, like where she's been told and schooled, I think, with him saying, you know, you've got to make these hard decisions if you're going to be CEO. And I think she takes that on board and in this position as well, you know, she likes being the person in the room who's got the plan and who's like, right, rally round, let's go, we're going this way. So just needs her brothers to follow her all the time.
Matthew, tell me a little bit about Tom in season three, because it felt like he was in some ways a real sort of arrogant opportunist, and by this point he's in season three, he's sort of willing to sacrifice himself. Is he kind of playing the long game, or was there a shift?
I don't know. I think he genuinely I don't know how calculating he is. I think that sort of comes to him, you know, the idea of offering himself up to Logan. I mean, what else is, he's got nothing else to lose, really. I mean, he's, you know, he's going to take the rap for it. And so maybe he's sort of, yeah, I mean, maybe there's an element of sort of, they're all survivors, really. You know, they have to be in that world. So there's an element of trying to sort of, what's the best, worst outcome?
Yeah.
And then it's that beautifully written scene, which we did, when he sort of, you know, he sees in Shiv the sort of, yeah, that could be a good idea, which is sort of the worst thing a wife could say to a husband, but actually is a practical, hard-nosed way of looking at it. You know, you bank gold with my dad.
Yeah.
You'd probably only serve a year in jail, right? So might be okay. Might be a good strategy. I mean, it's cool and sort of brilliant at the same time.
Yeah.
So
that's the thing. Like, oftentimes the scenes that we find the funniest are the ones that don't have the line, like between you and I, perhaps, don't have the lines that are the comedy lines, but are this the most heinous response from a wife? Or
yeah, it's the looks in between the line. You know, it's not about what they're saying always.
It's the painful silence in between. It's the drinking wine and not listening.
We sometimes talk about shows, you know, being the comedy of cringe. This is definitely like the tragedy of cringe. It's excruciating.
Good, yeah. It's a good description.
Yeah.
His obsession with jail really sort of gets raised to the to an art form. It's
scary. What can I say? I mean,
it's not that scary. It's just jail. It won't be that long.
How long am I allowed to, when's lights out? How long am I allowed to read?
Yeah. How long are you allowed to exercise for?
Yeah. I mean, do I have to go to the toilet in front of somebody else? How does it work? You know, all these questions going around his head.
Yeah.
And he's running a big, you know, he's running ATN. I mean, there's a lot. It's a lot to think about.
And trying to have a baby ahead of time so that there's a kid waiting for you.
Yeah.
Very organized, very thoughtful.
Yeah. They called it, what did they call it once? The mole? Like, you were trying to plant a mole in my womb while you were inside?
One on the inside, yeah.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Alan Ruck said that you were the cast goof, Matthew, that you are often break people up.
I don't recognize that description at all. I think that's unfair, Valen. Take it very seriously. The implication that I might be unprofessional sometimes is take lightly, yeah. Sarah would back me up.
Definitely. Oh no, Matthew's the most boring of us all.
I'd like to be, I like to just get through it and, you know.
Yeah, head down.
Yeah.
You're busy. You're busy working hard.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah,
always.
Not there to sort of have fun, you know. We have trouble sometimes. Because the scenes are so funny. I mean,
right.
Defy anyone. I mean, you know, it's really tough.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, there are also these virtuosic kind of group scenes in many episodes, and in this episode again, you have this gathering of people and so many things are going on. How choreographed is it?
I mean, it's not a lot. Talking to one of the editors last night, they were like, we've got so much footage to go through because we stay in the general area, but in order to get it to cut together, there's a lot that gets discarded because oftentimes we're not in the same spot or we're not saying the same line at the same time or we've improvised something. But that gives it its looseness and freedom and I think a lot of its vitality. Yeah.
And we have three cameras, you know, two or three cameras on all the time. So it's, you know, it allows us to be very loose with it. But that episode 5 is a good example, isn't it? Because there's a long, must be over 10 pages, that whole sequence.
Yeah, it was like 15. It was almost
really, 15. Yeah. I mean, it's a whole, and it just sort of, you only find that with a group of actors, it's like rehearsing a play, you know. Yeah. You find it with rehearsal and, you know, and you sort of finesse it, the more takes you do.
Yeah. It did feel like that, like a play, that one as well. And yeah. It felt like a French farce or
like
Tom and Jerry or something like.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Right. Yes, with Tom, you know, escorting Logan back and forth to the toilet and
the imaginary cat coming out in the bag, and then you know, it's just and all the while these huge high stakes are happening in another room off stage, you know. So it's sort of a classic.
It's... My favorite also is like, well, thanks, Papa.
Susan, one of the writers, just came in and just said, just say Papa in this one take. And so I thought, okay.
It's so genius. Yeah. It seems like such a strange afterthought. And so...
You know, he can't hear him. Yeah, yeah.
Because you also be like,
oh, benefit.
Yeah.
And he won't remember because, of course, he's out of his head.
That's right.
Yeah. I really felt for Tom this season. Like, we've got... Yeah, there's so much. You really go like, oh man.
Yeah, the pathos really comes through for Tom in this season.
Yeah.
So Shiv, you were sort of the token liberal Roy. Now you are inside. You're inside the evil empire.
Yeah.
Is there a line that Shiv won't cross?
That is interesting. Is there a line Shiv won't cross? I don't know. I hope to find it. That seems like a great area to be playing in, I think. She certainly crosses a line when she writes a very damning public letter about her brother. I think something very interesting about Shiv that I love playing is that she has an extraordinary ability to justify her actions to herself as necessary or obvious as an action to have taken. And so where that line is, I don't know yet, but we'll find it one day.
There's a brilliant, it's so interesting. There's a brilliant when you go and try and sort of recruit Lisa, Arthur, and you have a sort of mini fit when it doesn't work. There's that sort of element of like, you know, which is so, which is really Shiv as well. You know, it's a sort of.
I think we've seen new elements of Shiv this season.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of that you get, and you see it with the boys as well. It's that not getting your own way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, make it happen. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. It's
like a foot stamping thing. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And Logan has it too, you know. He sort of won't compromise until the FBI are at the door.
Yeah. You know,
battering rams.
So stubborn.
Yeah.
And uncompromising.
Yeah.
This season has kind of some fun with the malign power of ATN. I mean, they pushed the president to the breaking point, you know. During COVID, I feel like we've really seen the power of Republican media to affect public health. I wondered if you guys ever feel qualms in terms of, humanizing people who are, playing these like very serious games, because there are parallels to kind of real news. I mean, Tom is, seems to have some discomfort, but he's still, happy to push around ATN.
Oh, I was just going to say, you reminded me of this. This quote, I can't remember who it was by recently. Jeremy would know. He quotes and always knows the person it's coming from. No, but someone said recently that those who talk about us and them, like there is no us and them. It's only the danger is talking about us and them. And so humanizing people who do despicable things, I think, is a very important thing, I would say, in that, like, we are the ones who do those despicable things as well. You know, that's we have to know both sides. We have to know, we have to see each other as human, I think, if we're going to move forward.
I mean, because otherwise, it's true. You have to tell these stories and everyone's, no one's sort of soulless or, inherently evil. And, they're all sort of peddling agendas and, yeah.
It's also nice to, like, play a billionaire and realize that money doesn't make you happy. And if that's a message that can get out into the world, then great. Because right. There's a whole lot of hero worshipping of money and wealth and fame, I think, these days. And this at least casts a bit of a dark shadow over that.
Yeah. Right. Although I imagine some people watch it and go, like, well, they're not happy, but at least they have their private jets.
I hope not. Like, that is miss the point.
Yeah.
Yeah, the negotiations in this episode are hilarious, right? You know, the thing that gets Roman most upset is the idea that they're gonna lose their PJs.
Yeah. First they come for the PJs, then they come for the outsized compensation payments. It's like, you asshole. You don't get it.
He says the unsayable thing out loud, Roman. Yes,
always.
Kieran
does. As well.
so are there particular people who really are fun to play off of in terms of the unpredictable improvs?
Kieran's deadly, isn't he?
He's deadly. It's a great word for it. Yeah.
So yeah. Quick. It's speed of thought is so fast.
Yeah,
sort of. It's great. I mean, it's easier for me because Tom is slower, and so I can pretend it's Tom being, if I'm improvising with Kieran. But yeah, he's lightning quick and very funny.
I mean, it's easier for me as well in that, like, I think we've both sort of quite judiciously made choices about our characters that allow us a little space and airtime with a moment to just, process an accent. So Shiv just keeps her mouth shut a lot of the time.
Banging on her, yeah. It's very good. Nick is brilliant.
My favorite is being able to, like, hopefully have my scenes scheduled, back to something that Tom and Greg get to do, because then I might be able to be at the split and watch. They're really fun.
Really, do people stand around and watch other people's scenes?
Yeah, that's why it's so exciting watching the show for me, because of course, even though it's an ensemble piece, there's a lot of stuff you just don't see. You get an idea at the table read or whatever, but to see these wonderful scenes is a real treat, because you obviously don't see them and you forget it,
Yeah, them. Or you then wondering which take they're going to use, or which part, or which joke, or which gag bit you know, there was a moment where it was really fun. Our last day shooting this season, there was a scene that was happening in an office room, and I was in there first, and then Roman had to go in. I had to go get, it was like a camera kept rolling. And so Kieran had been like at the split watching, and then would, when on his cue, would then go over and like go into the scene, which, you know, some actors might find that quite distracting. And I was lucky that I came second. So then when I came off the scene, I went to the split and started watching his half of the scene. And so it was this really fun thing where we're like tag teaming each other in. I was like, you know, it felt like we were in a tennis match or something, like, all right, your turn, get in there.
Is it hard to sort of like wash Tom and Shiv off at the end of the day, or when you've had a particularly intense scene, or no, you just walk out and have a drink?
Just shed her, leave her behind. I'll take some elements with me. I like her confidence, and there are some things that I've learned from her that I'm like, okay, that's a good thing. That's a nice, you know.
I always say this, and I don't know whether you agree, but it's you take little parts of the characters you play, and you know, and you can sort of, it's actually acting as great therapy, because you can sort of, you can either borrow like qualities that you aspire to, like confidence or dynamism, and also you can sort of get out all the really disgusting things, you know, like I could. Like, Tom is so excruciatingly awful sometimes that it's sort of wonderful just to sort of do that.
Yeah.
I can feel like I've got it out of my system, or you know, be a big shouty bully, or, you know, whatever.
And then revert being back to normal, lovely, gentlemanly Matthew.
Great, yeah.
It's probably good for the people in your lives that you've got a place to exercise it.
Yeah. Right.
Do people recognize you on the street now? And what catchphrases do they want to hear from you?
Often you go, when's it coming back?
Yeah.
And you quite semi-aggressively. And you're like, I think like the autumn. And they're like, are you sure? When? Well, I'm not really sure. Well, like October, November? Yeah, around then. Okay, thanks. Bye.
That sounds very New York.
Yeah. No selfies. Just, when's it coming back? We need off.
So that's lucky that I don't have a catchphrase at all or anything like that. So no one yells anything at me. They just go like, "Ooh, look out."
Sometimes I get people shouting Greg at me. Not because they think I am Greg. It's just that they associate.
Greg!
Yo, Greg! And that's it.
Hello.
Yeah.
You can see why actors sometimes go out in disguise. Well, great. I really appreciate you you talking to us.
No worries. Of course, you're welcome.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you again for listening. Please, again, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can send us messages on subtext. And we'll be here next week to discuss episode 6. Until then, Sonia, where can people find you?
Well, hopefully I'll be interviewing Kendall Roy about how, you know, his mind's really set on change right now, and whatever it is, whatever that he doesn't want to tell Stewie and is saving for Vanity Fair. Hopefully that's what I'll be doing. But yeah, you can find me on vf.com.
And I will be making plans to go home for Thanksgiving, where I hope my mom calls me a visionary or someone does. Someone, please. I want to be a visionary. And I'll be tweeting at Rylas and writing at vf.com. As ever, this episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez.
Thanks, Dave. And thank you guys for listening. Talk to you soon.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors, as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.